DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme, Austrian elections. DW's reporting hits a snag.
Then they called me and said that they would only talk to us once they are electable in Germany. So that's what they said to me.
Brandenburg elections. A Pyrrhic victory for the SPD. And France's new government. There's a rocky road ahead. All that plus a heady day out at Oslo Innovation Week.
Startup Lab is Norway's largest tech incubator and most active early stage investor. Yes, we are an oil and gas country, but we're very aware of the fact that that won't last forever.
As autumn comes to Europe, 2024's bumper election year enters its final phase. One major signpost on the way is Austria, which goes to the polls in national legislative elections on September 29th. It's an election that is being watched keenly around Europe, with Austria's far-right FPÖ party under its hardline leader Herbert Kickl expected to come out top. Our Austrian-born reporter, Laura Kabelka, is part of DW's team on the ground. She spoke to me on Wednesday from her hotel room in Vienna and gave me this thumbnail portrait of the party that is dominating the national debate.
Right, so the FPÖ, or the Freedom Party, was actually founded in the 50s by former National Socialists. For the first decades, the party was relatively moderate, but since the 80s, they have taken a hardline stance on immigration issues and nationalism. If you look at their party program, and their leader right now is called Herbert Kickl, it is called Fortress Austria, literally. So you can get an idea. It shows the country of Austria and the fortress in the middle, basically showing that they want to protect their country and their people. That is what they stand for, and if you read into the party program, a lot of their focus goes on that. They also use terms such as remigration. They are also using terminology of extremist conspiracy theories such as the Great Replacement Theory. So they are basically saying that foreigners are replacing Austrian nationals.
However, this is of course a party that has been in power before, so what would be different this time?
They have been in power before. They were in several governing coalitions in the past. However, what I would say is different, first of all, is that now they are actually set to win, to come in first. This has never happened in the past. And another point I would like to make is that just because they have been previously in governing coalitions, that there is no such firewall against the far right in Austria as is in other countries like Germany or Belgium, it doesn't make their hardline stance on migration softer. So I'm not sure it's a good idea to go in that way of thinking and say this is a socially acceptable party, is how we say it in Austria, salonfähig machen.
Kickl, he has described himself as wanting to become the people's chancellor. That is an expression that I feel like I have heard before.
Yes, so this party is also very good at alluding to words and terms from the past. There is actually a very long list of cases of neo-Nazi slogans, anti-Semitism and racist slurs. And here in Austria, we kind of make a joke about that these are single cases, Einzelfälle. But as I said, there are archives of 100 and more cases like these. So it's nothing new.
Right. Okay. Because, of course, People's Chancellor was what Adolf Hitler called himself. That experience of tapping into the past, this sort of playing with rhetoric and expressions that evoke Austria's National Socialist past. Is that something that you have encountered, Laura, when you have been reaching out to the FPÖ in preparation for interviews?
So I wanted some clarifications about their party program because some parts are not quite clear exactly how they are meant. For instance, there was a part about how they want to impose a emergency law because Austria is taking above average migrants and refugees. So they would like to basically completely disregard asylum rights with this emergency law. So I had some questions because, in fact, the number of arrivals have gone down in the past year. So I wondered what they mean with above average. So I reached out to them, and then I only got a response that they wouldn't want to talk to me. Then I basically suggested to change the deadline. Then they called me and said that they wouldn't want to talk to international media right now because I was messaging from DW, unless, or they would only talk to us once they are electable in Germany. So that's what they said to me.
Right, so that's who you're not going to be talked to. Tell me about the people that you will be talking to, Laura, and why? Why have you chosen these voices for your reporting?
We are covering the national elections, but we will go to Carinthia mainly. We're also in Vienna, but mainly we're going to Carinthia because it has been voting more right-wing than the other federal states of Austria. We want to look at the reasons why that is, and we want to talk to people why they're voting for whom and for what party. But we're also following a young person of color who was born and raised in a small town in Carinthia. And we want to look at her experience of growing up there, what it was like, and also her current fears now that the far right is predicted to win these elections.
DW's Laura Kabelka there. To follow Laura's reporting from Austria, download the DW Breaking News app or follow the DW news handles on social media. More elections talk now as we check in with DW's political correspondent, Thomas Sparrow. Thomas has spent much of the week dissecting the political implications of regional elections in the eastern German state of Brandenburg last Sunday, where, against all earlier expectations, the far-right AfD was beaten into second place by the Social Democratic SPD party.
It was not the shock that many had expected. And that shock refers to a possible win of the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, similar to what had happened only a few weeks ago, in the state of Thuringia. And the AfD had been sort of leading in the polls, first or second. So there was a sort of idea that maybe the AfD could repeat that victory of Thuringia. That did not happen. Actually, the Social Democrats that have been in power in Brandenburg for 34 years, in other words, since Germany's reunification, managed to end in first place. It was a very narrow victory indeed for the Social Democrats. So 1 week on, there's a lot of discussion on the one hand as to why the Social Democrats managed to actually win, B, what this means not only for Brandenburg, but more importantly, for Germany as a whole, because as we all know from these regional elections, they may touch, at least in part, on topics that are local, but the impact of a regional election in Germany is always a national impact, one that is felt here in Berlin, in the center of Berlin, where we are now not far away from the German Chancellery and the German Parliament.
Right. OK, listen, I think we have to name check someone at this point, Thomas. Dietmar Woidke. So we had this surprise result that you've just outlined for me there. And a lot of it comes back to this man, right, who basically said, look, you know me. You trust me. I have been your minister president since 2013. But it's me or the AfD, right? If you don't bring my party out top, if we don't beat the AfD, then you won't see me again as your minister president. Doesn't matter what coalitions come together, I'm going. And this created a situation whereby the SPD was able to pull off what had seemed absolutely impossible just a few weeks before, but it came at the cost of other parties.
It came at the cost of other parties. So you can imagine that, for example, the Greens or the Liberals that had a very bad result, they're not even in the parliament. They are not very happy about the fact that Woidke presented this as either me or the AfD. There's been a lot of discussion, Kate, and we've discussed this here even on the programme several times. How should other parties react to the AfD's popularity? And what we've seen specifically in Brandenburg is that when politicians make it personal, when they focus not necessarily on the big political parties, if they make it personal about a politician that is popular in a specific region, and it is made as a dilemma between the AfD or another party, in this case the Social Democrats, then that other party can come out in a victorious position. It doesn't always mean that that's the case, but at least now it's being discussed that that could be at least a strategy that could be presented, let's say, in a more broader way, how to deal with far-right parties.
So building up local candidates as a potential strategy going forwards. I just wanted to throw in the fact that Olaf Scholz, Thomas, he actually lives in Brandenburg, doesn't he? He's in Potsdam.
He lives in Brandenburg in Potsdam. So in other circumstances, in a different situation, I think any social democratic candidate would have been happy to have Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, present in the campaigning ahead of the elections. But this was really not the case. It was even very clear from early on that the Social Democrats in Brandenburg wanted to have a political campaign that was focused on Wojtke and not on Olaf Scholz. In other words, that Olaf Scholz was basically not welcome in Brandenburg. That was not said very openly, but it was at least the impression that was given to voters. This is about Brandenburg. This is not about the federal government. And that strategy is directly linked to the fact that voters are very critical of the German federal coalition under Olaf Scholz. They are less critical of Dietmar Woidke's leadership in Brandenburg.
So very much Dietmar Woidke's victory, a bit of a Pyrrhic victory, perhaps, because one of the main consequences of this It's Me or the AfD strategy was that he gained a lot of votes from, for example, the Green Party, who did not make, as a result, the 5%, or as partly as a result, the 5% hurdle needed in order to get into the state parliament, which means that Woidke and the SPD are in a bit of a pickle when it comes to coalition partners. Perhaps you could pick up there, Thomas.
I would also describe this as a Pyrrhic victory because it leaves a very difficult situation in Brandenburg with only four parties in the regional parliament: the Social Democrats, the AfD, the Conservative CDU, and the Zara Wagenknecht Alliance. Basically, the Greens and the Liberals are out of the parliament in Brandenburg. And as you stressed, maybe for Woidke himself, that was something that was an important victory. He may remain in as the leader of the region. He can continue his policies. The SPD can still continue governing a region that has been one of its absolute key strongholds since reunification. But it comes at a cost. And it comes at a cost also, again, if we look at it from the federal perspective. Everyone has one eye on what happened in the eastern states of Brandenburg, Thuringia and Saxony, and the other eye already on what's going to happen next year at the federal elections.
DW's political correspondent Thomas Sparrow there. The AfD, by the way, may have come second in Brandenburg, but after gaining over a third of the votes, it has a so-called Sperrminorität, or minority veto, which will give it the power to, for example, block nominations to the Constitutional Court. In other words, there's a rocky road ahead. The same of which can almost certainly be said for France's new government under surprise pick Prime Minister Michel Barnier. The cabinet got down to work this week with a crackdown on immigration and the country's massive budget deficit top of its agenda. But many in France are deeply unhappy with the government's makeup, which they say is simply not reflective of the will of the people, as expressed in this summer's legislative elections. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
The first day in office for France's new ministers, members of President Emmanuel Macron's centrist coalition and the centre-right. French politics have been in limbo since inconclusive snap legislative elections in late June and early July. That saw a leftist coalition, the New Popular Front, win the most votes, and the far-right National Rally emerging as the single largest party. This new government, headed by Conservative Prime Minister Michel Barnier, doesn't include either of these blocs.
Nous vous présentons aujourd'hui avec David, eh bien, un texte juridique
Barnier earned respect in Europe as a European Union commissioner handling the Brexit negotiations. Governing France is a different matter.
Le sentiment que les frontières sont des passoires.
Barnier has outlined some broad priorities, including controlling immigration. There's this sentiment, he says, that the borders are like sieves and migration isn't managed. We're going to manage migration, he says, not with ideology or speeches, but with concrete acts. He's tapped an immigration and security hardliner, Bruno Retailleau, as his new interior minister. Analysts believe the move reflects the government's current dependence on the far right's tacit support to stay in office.
C'est une possibilité.
Avec l'ensemble du gouvernement qui doit se réunir demain pour la première fois.
Oui. Barnier also calls for a national effort to cut France's budget deficit well over the EU limit. He's calling for taxing rich individuals and companies, but he says he will not touch other areas like gay marriage and a recent move to enshrine abortion freedoms in the French constitution. Barnier's new government is already feeling the heat. Thousands demonstrated in Paris even before his cabinet was named.
Monsieur Barnier et son gouvernement n'ont aucun avenir parce que quoi qu'il arrive.
Far-left politician Jean-Luc Mélenchon claims the new government has no future, a prognosis echoed by National Rally leader Jordan Bardella. A new poll shows just 25% of French support President Macron and 39% support his prime minister. The left has vowed a no-confidence motion to bring the government down. Analysts say that for now, it isn't likely to succeed. But there's also no honeymoon period for Barnier and his ministers. Their tenure is fragile in a country that seems as politically divided as ever. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
That is enough political gridlock for one week. We'll be immersing ourselves in forward-looking visions of the future next, so do stay tuned. That's here with me, Kate Laycock, on Inside Europe. This week in the Norwegian capital, hundreds of green technology startups, investors and decision makers have gathered for Oslo Innovation Week. Top of the agenda, how can the Norwegian economy thrive in a post-fossil fuel future? It's a big question for a nation whose wealth is built on fossil fuel production. But for the big questions, we have Lars Bevanga.
Well, this is not for the faint-hearted, and I don't mean the outlook for Norway's economy post-oil. I've just climbed up onto the roof of Norway's national football stadium, and the view of the pitch some 20 metres below me is spectacular, I must admit. But the reason I'm here is to take a look at a groundbreaking solar power installation.
This is the biggest installation in the world using vertical bifacial solar panels. And it's a product developed by a Norwegian startup called Overeasy Solar.
Trygve Mongstad is the CEO and founder of Overeasy Solar, a company only 3 years old that has its eyes set on the world. Their solar panels cover vast swathes of this football stadium roof.
And the vertical panels very well catch the light during the winter time, but it's also a very lightweight system, working for rooftops that cannot take the weight of a conventional type of solar installation.
You're a very young company. You've grown pretty quickly. How has the help available from investors, but also the state, been beneficial to you?
It's been very, very important. We've had very good support from Oslo municipality for doing R&D and pilots in the small scale in the beginning, support from Innovation Norway and Norwegian Research Council. So definitely this kind of support is needed in order to be able to develop a new product like this.
Good morning, everyone, and well met. My name is Fredrik Darien, founder of Carbon Dynamics.
Norway's going to need a lot of companies like OverEasy Solar. The annual Oslo Innovation Week is a chance for green technology startups to showcase their ideas. Here at Startup Lab, some of them are given a chance to pitch their solutions to potential investors.
At Carbon Dynamics, we have a vision to transform CO2 into new valuable products with the use of advanced biotechnology.
My name is Karl Lyapunov. I run the energy and climate tech program here at Startup Lab. Startup Lab is Norway's largest tech incubator and most active early stage investor. Yes, we are an oil and gas country, but we're very aware of the fact that that won't last forever. We need to diversify.
Karl Lyapunov is an optimist, but also realistic. He sees three main obstacles facing Norwegian startups.
Lack of capital, hard time retaining talent. It's not the easiest place to convince people to move to. And probably, you know, sales teams. Norwegians are introverted. We're a little more, we've built amazing technology, but we're not amazing at selling it.
So what are the advantages that Norway has?
Those are, I mean, how long do you have? There's a long history of energy expertise in Norway. Granted, it's mostly in oil and gas, but we also have 95% of the power that gets produced in Norway is renewable through hydropower. So you have people who have worked in the industry for a really long time and have a really high level of expertise.
Well, for Norway, innovation is not an option, it's a must.
Håkon Haugli is the CEO of Innovation Norway, which is owned by the Norwegian government. They provide loans and grants and advice for companies wanting to operate abroad.
We need to replace our most profitable, our largest industry with something else. And that something else has to be a lot of different things. It has to be digital, it has to be green, and it has to be at scale to matter. It makes my heart beat really fast to see young founders with great ideas actually connecting with investors and customers and making it happen. I am a concerned optimist. I think not to underestimate the challenges, but yes, I think we can make it, both as a country, but also develop and scale solutions that the world really needs.
We need to get out on the international market, finding partners for international scaling in Germany.
Back on the football stadium roof, OverEasy Solar CEO Trygve Mongstad is considering how to move from successful Norwegian startup to global player.
For that part, it's a bit more difficult, I must admit. There are not so many support schemes that I would wish for. We have had some very good support, but when we're scaling up and becoming a bigger company, we more depend on the private investors.
Here at Oslo Innovation Week, there is no shortage of great ideas and optimism for the future. Norway's challenge, though, is monumental. EU's goal to cut fossil fuel dependency by 90% will leave a €33 billion hole in the Norwegian budget. And time is running out. Lars Bevanger, DW, Oslo.
Where there's a will, there's a sovereign wealth fund, as I'd like to imagine that they say in Norway. In honour of Oslo Innovation Week, we've created a Spotify poll all about Norwegian inventions. Head on over to this week's edition of the show on Spotify to take part. Anyway, our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. I have to say that opening the mailbag is genuinely one of my favourite parts of the job, so please do keep reaching out with your comments and ideas for the show. You can, of course, also leave us a comment or a rating via the various podcast apps, or, you know what, even better, why not recommend us to a friend? This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. In the next half hour, come back. Croatia's bid to reverse its youth exodus. Sun, sea and sustainable tourism. Meet the marine biologist greening up your next holiday. Olympic legacy, all aboard the newly extended Paris Metro. And forbidden sounds. But what's so subversive about this music? All will be revealed at the end of the show. Stay tuned. So a slight bit of Euro trivia here, but just indulge me for a sec. Eurovision fans amongst you may remember that this year's runner-up was a bizarre and humorous Croatian act called Baby Lasagna with a song called Rim Tim Taggy Dim. Well, that song was actually about the pain of emigration, and that's a big topic in Croatia right now. This week, Croatia's government announced measures designed to encourage people who've left the country to return. The Croatian population has declined by a tenth over the past decade, as hundreds of thousands of people, and we're talking here mostly about young people, seek opportunities elsewhere. So, why are young people leaving, and what might entice them to return? Our Balkans correspondent, Gajda Lorne, has been finding out.
This is Rijeka, Croatia's third largest city. And as you can hear, there's plenty of building work going on as reconstruction work continues following Rijeka's year as European Capital of Culture in 2020. Now, this may seem like a place on the up, but that doesn't mean that its young people begin to stay.
The cost of living, actually, have really increased in Croatia. Even our nearby countries, such as Slovenia, such as Austria, Germany, the salaries are really higher.
Jakov Juric is training to be a doctor, and he's also head of the Medical Students Association in Rijeka.
Croatian society, in general, doesn't really appreciate the young people. That's probably why young people are constantly just leaving the country.
When you say that young people aren't appreciated, how does that manifest itself?
Well, I think they're not given enough opportunities for work, for life. Prices of living or for apartments, houses and everything is just going up constantly.
But it's not just Rijeka facing an exodus of its young people. When it comes to where they see their future, Croatians have been voting with their feet for decades. But the youth exodus accelerated significantly 11 years ago. That's when Croatia joined the European Union, and young people quickly took advantage of the bloc's freedom of movement. The national census shows the country lost 400,000 people over a 10-year period. That's a tenth of the population. If departures continue at such a rate, the future looks grim for Croatia.
I'm Snježana Prič Samarja. I'm director of the University of Rijeka. They decided that probably they will have the better life and the better chances and the better circumstances there than in Croatia. So that's my problem.
What is it that they're saying is better elsewhere than it is here?
I think that the main problem here is that the young people do not perceive that everything depends on them. Many things depend on the politics. Many things depend on whether you are or not a member of one or another party. That you have a kind of support of one or another interest group.
Some of those who've left may have gone for good. It's a warm early evening at a pub almost 2,000 kilometres away from Rijeka in Weybridge, not far south of London. This swish suburb is now home to Croatian architect Veron Medic, and he has no regrets about swapping Rijeka for the London commuter belt.
I made the right choice. I think I have about 6 or 7 Croatian friends at the moment that are spread around England and studying and working here. I don't think any of them has plans to go back home in the near future.
What do you think the consequences are for Croatia of all this young talent leaving, as it has done, in its tens of thousands?
The fact that some of the brightest minds are not in Croatia at the moment, I think it's ridiculous, and I think it should definitely change. They should try and find a way to make Croatia a place that young people, where young people want to stay and build their careers.
Even the considerable charms of the Adriatic coast won't be enough to lure Veron back to Croatia, not for more than a holiday at any rate. And that stance is typical of many Croatians who believe that career opportunities and higher pay outweigh ties to the homeland. So now Croatia's government is trying a fresh approach involving financial incentives. People who return from other countries will be exempt from income tax for 5 years, and there'll be new taxes on holiday homes to encourage property owners to make long-term rents available for young people and families. That's on top of a range of incentives already available for prodigal Croats.
The incentive is 7,000 euros if you are coming from abroad.
Jelko Marković runs the government's I Choose Croatia program in Rijeka.
We are now developing a larger national package. The new government was formed, and for the first time Croatia has Ministry of Demographics and Immigration. It's basically called that. So we are through various measures, we will try to return our people from abroad. This measure, I choose Croatia, is just one little part of that entire package.
Perhaps the latest incentives will cause the tide to turn, but the path to other countries has become so well travelled that young Croatians may still feel it's the easier route to take. Guy Delaunay, DW, Rijeka.
I think I may have to say at this point that we have categorically not partnered with the Croatian government on their comeback home drive. But if you are a homesick Croatian abroad, beware, because this next item might pack a punch. Alexandra Ali Dragozet is a marine biologist and founder of the sustainable tourism consultancy Sea Going Green. And both Ali's twin passions, marine biology and sustainability entrepreneurship, have their roots in Croatian beaches. Ali was also a proud ambassador to this year's One Young World Summit, which finished last week in Montreal, Canada. Here she is in her own words.
So nice to meet you. I'm Ali Dragozet, and I'm the founder and CEO of Sea Going Green. I'm also a marine biologist who used to work in the tourism industry, and I am Serbian Croatian, raised in Canada and now based in the Netherlands in Amsterdam. So that is my short intro. Even though we were based in Toronto for most of my childhood, we spent all the summers kind of back in Croatia visiting family, and we're really lucky enough that we were from quite a small beach town there. And this area was really not super touristic when I was really young, but year by year, we're really seeing more and more kind of tourists arrive at this area. Everyone, you know, we have fantastic beaches there, though the water quality was great. It's really where I fell in love with the ocean. I mean, I think there's a very non-traditional way of learning how to swim, you know, the dads would just throw you in the water and hope you would float. And that's really where I fell in love with the oceans. Seeing more and more tourists come every year, we were unfortunately also seeing the water quality going down. And I think as a child, I really was seeing this kind of in live action. You know, we were diving, we were snorkeling, and all of a sudden you were seeing, oh, you know, there's not that many fish anymore, or there used to be more fish in this area. The water quality was kind of going down. And then we kind of correlated this, you know, with more and more people coming, and also kind of these unregulated tourism practices that we were seeing globally. But of course, for me, it was really evident evident in Croatia with more people, you know, for us equaled, you know, lower marine quality and lower marine biodiversity. And that's really where I said, you know, this is a really interesting relationship between local communities and the marine environment. Because on one hand, tourism was really being a force of good in this area, because local communities can, you know, work for a couple months of the year and live off that for the rest of the year. But then we were seeing lower, you know, marine biodiversity, water quality, and these kinds of things. So I was always curious kind of how we can make the balance between these two better and work together. So I'm a solutions person. I think anyone close to me will tell you, you know, I'm definitely the person you come to for solutions. So we, our big mission is really to alleviate the negative impacts of tourism on the environment as a whole. We started working with just the marine environment, as I was the founder, but as the team grew, we also looked at other environments as well. So now we're kind of also focusing on urban areas, forested areas, desert areas, so not just marine areas. And we work with both private and public sector. So we started working with private sector, really directly working with yachting companies, river cruise companies, small coastal hotels, really from the private sector, and looking at where their biggest sustainability impacts were. I really wanted a metric-based approach. I think being a marine biologist, I'm into numbers, so I was always trying to see how can we really measure the impact. And, you know, there's the saying, you can't manage what you can't measure. So if we wanted to do some sort of kind of strategies, we wanted it to be focused on metrics. So we work with carbon right now in carbon accounting for private sector clients. And then we make strategies when we see where their biggest impacts are. How can we actually operationally make strategies to lower that impact? And then anything along the way that they might need in terms of other kind of green products or services. We have a great network of other amazing green entrepreneurs. So we connect them if they need any kind of capacity building training programs, both in-house, so for their teams, but also any kind of green branding and communications for their end consumers, so for their customers. We also work with some kind of more sustainable luxury hotel developments to make sure that they're building green from day one. So that's kind of the private sector side of things. And then the other side of the business is with public sector. So we're lucky enough to work directly with governments of ministries of tourism and development banks to make really destination-wide sustainable tourism strategies, marine tourism roadmaps. So this is really quite high-level policy work that we do, which is really exciting for me because, you know, private sector moves really fast and you can try a lot of different strategies there. But at the same time, policy always supports this kind of development. So we kind of like working both top-down and bottom-up with both private and public sector. One of my favorite places would probably have to be in Indonesia. You would just see the big blue. I mean, I think for some people, diving could be quite intense because it's just a lot of blue at some point when you get to a certain depth. But let's say about 10, 15 meters, you're seeing hopefully a healthy reef in an area. You're hopefully seeing beautiful schools of reef fish. Maybe if you're lucky, a turtle. And then you're just kind of enjoying stillness. You know, it's a really big privilege to be able to go diving and enjoy the marine environment.
Marine biologist Ali Dragazet is the founder of the sustainable tourism consultancy Sea Going Green. She's also an Audi Environmental Foundation scholar and a 2024 ambassador to One Young World, which is just finished in Montreal. And we will be profiling other European One Young World ambassadors next week. From the scenic depths of the ocean to the rather less scenic depths of the Paris metro system. Hell is other people, the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said, and something tells me that he might have been a metro user. Anyway, speculation aside, what is certain is that Paris's venerable underground transport system has, merci Olympic legacy, just been given a big and very significant extension. So big and significant, in fact, that they are calling it the Grand Paris Express. John Lawrenson was at the opening.
La gare Saint-Denis-Pleyel. President Macron opening a new station, Saint-Denis Pleyel, that's on the giant scale of the Grand Paris Express. 9 levels, 4 of them underground, 56 escalators.
Hello.
Welcome. Nice to meet you.
I meet up with Valérie Pécresse, one of the politicians who was standing on the stage with President Macron. She's president of the Greater Paris region and ran for the presidency of France itself 2 years ago. She's also president of the Greater Paris Transport Authority, and the Grand Paris Express is her pride and joy.
It's the doubling of all the metro lines in Paris. It's 330 kilometers of new lines and 70 new stations. We are already the second densest network in the world, and we have 9 million users every day. So it's a very long network. It compares to London, New York, and Tokyo.
Attention à la marge. En descendant du train, please mind the gap between the train and the platform. Achten Sie auf den Abstand zwischen Zug und Bahnsteigkante.
We're travelling on the newly extended North-South Line 14 that now goes to Orly Airport. The first part of Line 15, a mega circle line, will open next year. Then, in quick succession, we'll open up the 16, linking suburbs out east, the 17, that'll go up to Charles de Gaulle Airport, and the 18, that'll link suburbs south and west. The total cost is €42 billion.
What we want to create is what I call the region of the 20 minutes. A 20-minute region is a region where you can find everything at less than 20 minutes from where you live. Employment, public services, schooling, training.
It's pretty impressive, the speed, huh?
It is, isn't it?
So this is like twice the speed of a normal metro?
Yes, it's 80 kilometers per hour.
Bonjour les enfants.
A school group visiting the Fabrique du Métro, the Metro Factory, a museum in honour of the Grand Paris Express. There's a scale model of one of the 11 giant mechanical moles that have been tunnelling away in the bowels of the earth beneath Paris for a decade already. Also a life-size carriage of one of the new trains, very spacious, 2.8 metres wide, with a display on the platform that tells you which bits of the next train are the most crowded. I'm here with someone whose slightly insanely large knowledge of trains includes the interesting fact that the least crowded place to get on an underground train is usually the middle. He is Patrick Laval of the magazine La Vie du Rail, Rail Life. The Grand Paris Express, he tells me, represents a radical rethink of the way people get around.
Alors après-guerre, donc il y a eu un enrichissement général.
In the prosperous period after the Second World War, it was thought that people would use cars to get from suburb to suburb and only use trains to get in and out of the city. So lines that circled the city were actually closed. The metro system was given a sort of star shape, with all lines leading in and out of the center. But now the roads are too congested. The main purpose of the Grand Paris Express is to go from suburb to suburb. Now it's going to take you 5 or 10 minutes to do a trip between suburbs that used to take an hour, because you had to go into the city and come out again.
Mais là, on est à 60 kilometers, allez 70, de Paris, du centre-ville.
Cycling through a very countrified part of the Paris region with Renaud Charles, the co-founder and editor of a website of things to do in the Greater Paris area called Enlarge Your Paris. He lives out here. For him, the Grand Paris Express is going to create a new Parisian identity, including green places like this. People are going to start seeing themselves as belonging to this enormous territory that the Supermetro will cover.
Le Grand Paris Express va redéfinir les frontières.
The Grand Paris Express is going to reveal a new city, a city on the scale of a major metropolis. This is a huge transformation because the city of Paris, the municipality of Paris, is only 100 square kilometers, whereas the municipality of London, for example, is 1,600 square kilometers, 16 times larger than Paris. But in reality, Paris doesn't live within those 100 square kilometers. A massive amount of the economic activity of the city, and not just the economic activity, but cultural and leisure activity as well, takes place outside of the city. So what the Grand Paris Express is going to do is link them together more firmly and redraw people's mental map of the city. It's simple. Where there's the metro, there's the city. The metro puts you on the map.
Back on the vast plaza in front of the newly opened Saint-Denis Pleyel station, President Macron leaves the area, surrounded by cameras and microphones. And once he's gone, the public is allowed in, the very first members of the public to use the station and the newly extended line. I get talking to one of them. Her name is Naima.
Alors, la 14, vous voyez ça?
Where?
Si la limite...
She lives, oh joy, by one of the first Grand Paris Express stations that have just opened and shows me a photo on her phone of her balcony with an orange juice on the table and in the background the metro sign. The orange juice was to celebrate, she says. The super metro, she says, is going to change the lives of many people like her.
Il y a beaucoup de gens quand même qui se lèvent très très tôt.
There are a lot of people in the suburbs who get up early in the morning to go to work, who spend a very long time waiting for the bus, often in the bitter cold in winter. And they frequently have all sorts of combinations of transport. They take the bus to the tram to the overground train to the metro. Often they have to drop their children off at the kindergarten along the way. Most of the time, there's not enough room to sit down, so they stand, crushed against each other or up against the window. When they finally arrive at work, they're tired, and they've already used up a good part of the day with 1, maybe 2 hours on public transport. And in the evening, it's the same thing all over again. How productive can someone be if he or she arrives at work already exhausted? It's something that's difficult to measure. But you can bet that making traveling in the suburbs quicker, more efficient and more pleasant is going to make people more productive.
A revolution is underway in Paris for mobility, for the economy, for the very identity of the 10 million people who live in the Paris region. John Lawrence, DW Paris.
Sometimes it really is quite literally about connection. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Now, we are very excited to be ending today's programme with a world first. Until last week, no female artist is on record as ever having performed the instruments you are about to hear in public. The reason? In their home country, Equatorial Guinea, women are prohibited from playing them. History was made, however, when the 23-year-old Ghanaian musician Maria Dolores Nchama took to the stage in Madrid's Thyssen Bornemisza Museum. Our Spain correspondent, Ashish Sharma, had front row tickets.
I am going to speak a little about how women have lived in my country, how they have been restricted in the past and how this prohibition continues today. So, I want to introduce some music from instruments which women are not allowed to touch and play.
Maria Dolores had never been abroad before this visit to Spain. She travelled by herself and brought with her instruments varying from different drums to harps and even cymbals. These are instruments women in Equatorial Guinea are forbidden from touching, let alone playing in a concert.
We are told that there are traditional explanations and reasons behind why each one of these instruments can't be played by women. But I don't think that's right. I've never found one reason why a woman can't play them. So my objective here is to break with this tradition, break with this prohibition, and show that women also have a right and that they can play them.
In her first ever concert held outside Guinea, Maria hopes to not only highlight the cultural disadvantages women face in her country, but relate them to the inequality that women in other cultures also experience. It's offered her an opportunity to also showcase herself as an artist.
I'm Semiramis González. I'm an independent art curator, and I'm curating this performance cycle in Europe and United States, but mostly Europe, until 16th and 17th centuries, women aren't allowed to play music, some instruments. Talking now into present time, I think it's important to see that there aren't the same opportunities for women in each part of the world, and the opportunities for them are completely different. For me, it's very interesting to use this kind of contemporary art, which is the performance. You don't have to know anything about the performance, anything about contemporary art, but you can understand what the artist wants to say.
Maria told me that she had a mixed reaction from people in Guinea when she explained she'd been invited to play this concert in the Thyssen Museum.
Some people said to me, "What's this? What are you doing? You know, women can't play these instruments." People were saying things and sending me messages reminding me that I am not allowed to play them. Then there were others who, for the love of culture, permitted this. And of course, amongst them are those that taught me how to play.
Amongst the many who came to see Maria perform was one member of the audience who I was most interested in speaking to, a man from Equatorial Guinea. So what did he make of it?
This young lady from my country, I think he's doing something very, very special. Maybe he's going to do him here in Europe, not in our home in Equatorial Guinea, because in another conception. But here, when he start to do this, it's to send a message for another young people, another young girls, to tell them this is art, this is our history, and we can explain about our history. Now we have the tradition, now we have the modernities, and now we have the evolution of human beings. So the women, they need to speak, they need to, and music is to speak. So maybe you're going to look at other traditions, something, we're going to look something like this, but really, 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 we need to get the women everywhere, and the prohibition of to play this instrument is one of the stupid message in this world about men fighting against woman evolution.
Espero que las demás mujeres también. I hope that as a result, more women become involved, because I know that there are a lot who want to do this. They want to play, but they are forbidden from doing so. But why is this? It's because women have always been told that they are not supposed to. So, if I play these instruments and if I become the first woman to play them, then for sure they will take note and others will be right behind me wanting to learn.
Whilst groundbreaking to have a Guinean artist perform using instruments she would be banned from playing in her country, the artistic program organized by Semiramis and executed by the Thyssen has been innovative in offering female artists like Maria a stage to express the issues that concern them the most. The hope is that the 23-year-old, so determined to break with sexist traditions of her country, will not only begin a new artistic journey of her own, but in doing so will inspire other young women to follow in her footsteps. Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
And as Maria plays us out, there is just time for me to remind you of our feedback address, insideeurope@dw.com. This programme was produced by Helen Sini with help from me, Kate Laycock, and sound engineer Ziad Abu Sleiman. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.